From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. First this morning, writer Ed Conway shares with us the fascinating story of the material world, the six raw materials that shape modern civilization. Listen to the history of sand, salt, iron, copper, oil, and lithium. Then, science journalist Umberto Basilio joins to talk about the relative stability of the system of ocean currents called the Atlantic Meridional, overturning circulation, or AMOC, and its vital role in our climate. Stay tuned for these guests. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Our next guest is writer and broadcaster Ed Conway. He'll share with us the story of the material world, about the materials of sand, salt, iron, copper, oil, and lithium, and more. These fundamental materials have created empires, raised civilizations, and fed our ingenuity and greed for thousands of years. Without them, our modern world wouldn't exist, and the battle to control them will determine our future. Ed's book, Material World, The Six Raw Materials That Shape Modern Civilization, was the New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and Economist Best Book of the Year. Ed Conway, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me on.
Ed, you start your book talking about not only not one of these six materials, but of gold, and you start your book west of Salt Lake City in the Nevada desert.
Yeah, I get part of it, definitely. I had this moment where I went to a gold mine, the Cortez gold mine in Nevada. And it was the first time I'd ever seen large scale mining in action. And that is, if you or any of your listeners have experienced that before, it is quite a profound experience, just because the scale of what it takes to get stuff out of the ground, it's usually beyond your capacity to imagine these things. You know, the size of these trucks is just bigger than you can possibly imagine. And photographs, generally speaking, don't do it justice. And I just had this moment kind of standing there and watching them basically obliterate this mountain, which is what you have to do if you're mining gold in that particular way. Turns out you're not kind of going after little nuggets in the ground. You're tearing down mountains and you're processing the stuff. I just had this moment where I was kind of thinking, gosh, well, I'm a part of this. You know, I just got married. I bought my engagement ring and all of that stuff. And I didn't conceive that I was part of this quite destructive supply chain when I was doing that. And it struck me, well, this is probably only the tip of the iceberg. There are so many other ways in which we, the consumer, are kind of enveloped in this other world that's on the other, usually on this other side of the world. It's kind of, you know, away from our eyes. And yet without that part of the world, everything else just crumples. And so gold is just like, the point with gold is we could probably kind of get away with having civilization if we didn't have gold. Whereas steel, you know, getting iron out of the ground, you need that. Without steel, we're gone. Without silicon for silicon chips, we're in enormous trouble. And so that after that, there was this kind of imaginative question of like, what are the things we really need? And how do we get them out of the ground? Is it just as destructive as this? And what are the conversions? What are the kind of ways that we're converting it into amazing products? Because, you know, a silicon chip feels like it's this ultra clean technical thing, and you know they make them in the cleanest environments known to man. You know, the TSMC fab plant that's being built in Arizona is supposedly going to be the cleanest place on earth. Well, actually, it still starts with a rock. Everything in our world, everything in our lives starts pretty much with something we get out of the ground, and we just forget that, I think, a lot of the time. I certainly forgot that, and I think a lot of us tend to, because we work in airy-fairy occupation, well, in my case, like journalism, I'm a journalist, and we think that ideas are all that matters. But in reality, physical stuff is still the foundation that enables us to do the rest of it all.
We love to hate on mining, and we love to use the products that mining enables to be produced. And we love when mining takes place elsewhere, so we don't have to look at it. But it's what you, in your book, you really bring to light, and especially now, the critical minerals used in pretty much every, you know, that phone that we're never without, so crucial to our world. Do you think we're evolving to say, like, wait a minute, we can't hate on mining, or we need to bring it home so that we know what it is that we're using?
I think it's like, it's naturally a conflicted thing. It involves, we have a footprint, and we struggle with that, I think, and understandably so, because we don't like the idea that we are leaving a footprint. And I think we're much more conscious of it these days because of our awareness of the science of climate change and carbon emissions, and also other things, you know, like the ozone layer and other types of pollution. So we're more aware of it now. But the problem is that so much of our standard of living just can't happen without that other stuff. Yeah, we can do it in a more sustainable way, and we should do. But mining is still massively destructive and dirty. It just is. There is a large proportion. I can't remember whether it's like 5% or so of the planet's energy, which is given over to basically blowing up and crushing rocks. And then we turn them and process them into the steel that we need if you want to have, you know, hospitals and high-speed rail and all of those other kind of things we rely on in developed societies. But you still kind of need the rocks. And I think it's easy to just assume that there will be this kind of pristine, perfect world that we get to in 2050 where we have no footprint on the planet. But it's very hard then when you actually look at our actual interaction with the world, when you think about how we get the food that we need, you know, which, by the way, involves quite a lot of mining as well, mining to get the fertilizers and the other kind of materials we need to then grow the stuff. When you think about all of these different things, you see the footprint quite radically. And that footprint is not getting smaller. Over the last kind of 10, 20 years, the footprint, our human footprint on the planet in terms of just pulling stuff out of the ground and turning it into products, that has got bigger and bigger and bigger. And the paradox about carbon reduction and net zero is that if we are going to get there and eliminate our carbon emissions, or at least get them down a lot, which is the plan that most countries have, then you need to get even more stuff out of the ground, because you need more copper for the power networks that you're going to have in the future. Because getting to net zero basically means replacing a lot of fossil fuel production with things like solar and wind, but it also means electrifying everything. And to electrify everything, you need a lot more copper. And if we're going to get that copper, we have to have way more big holes in the ground than we've ever had before. Who wants us to have a cleaner planet don't want to countenance the notion that in order to have that cleaner planet, we need to dig up a lot of stuff to do it. But you can mine in a more sustainable way than we used to in the past, but you still have a footprint, and you're still going to be doing stuff that is pretty destructive and pretty dirty.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with London-based writer and broadcaster Ed Conway. He's written a book called The Material World, about the materials our modern world relies upon. Well, Ed, here's kind of a philosophical question, I guess. Why do we have so much stuff to begin with? I mean, we all have our smartwatches and our phones and our computers, and all of this requires more and more materials. Couldn't we just maybe cut back a little bit?
Yeah, I think we could, and we probably should, Katie. I mean, like if you think about it, we don't probably need as many cars as we have. The cars don't need to be as big as they are. You know, in recent years, there's this amazing phenomenon whereby car makers have got much better at using less steel and aluminium in their cars, aluminum, sorry. They've got better at using less of those metals and materials. The problem is that we just want bigger cars these days, and so it's all SUVs. The problem is we want more stuff in the cars. So you want your kind of sat-nav system and all of the other different bits and pieces. Well, that means having to use a lot more semiconductors, a lot more glass, a lot more LCDs. And so there's these two kind of things going on. On the one hand, I think a lot of businesses have got a lot better at being kind of more efficient. On the other hand, we as consumers have become not greedy, but we love new stuff. We just love new stuff. And it was not that long ago, as you'll probably remember, that the Nobel Prize, I think, for chemistry was given to three Japanese scientists for discovering the LEDs, like the blue LED that then enabled us to have white LEDs. And they said, this is amazing because this is going to basically save the planet. Because as a result of this, LEDs have much less energy consumption than your typical halogen or incandescent light bulb. And as a result of this, we are going to use much less energy in future. And that's true if you assume that the amount of lighting demand across the planet is going to stay the same. But the reality is that over the years, we just have, in the intervening period even, we've just come up with ever more ways of deploying LEDs. Like if you go around at Christmas time, you know, to your local park, there'll be these, you know, Christmas shows where you'll have the lights everywhere. If you've got a new car, you might have those exciting new headlights that do it's called a matrix LED system that basically kind of does the auto dimming. And in theory, each of those little LED diodes has much less energy consumption, but put the whole matrix together and actually the consumption is greater than for the halogen light bulbs that we used to use years ago. So our appetite, there's this idea in economics called the Jevons paradox, which this guy called William Stanley Jevons, he was an economist years ago, and he basically realized that even as we made more efficient like steam engines, instead of just making do with the amount of energy we needed in the past, this is back in the Industrial Revolution, we came up with ever new ways of deploying steam power. And that's kind of what we always do as humans. And on the one hand, that's the ingenuity, you know, that's the amazingness of being a human and creating economic activity. On the flip side, it's very hard to square those two things.
Well, thank you for creating the segue of one of my favorite things to talk about is, okay, yes, the LEDs save electricity. However, and this goes to the electric vehicles, everything, it's the manufacturing process that so many of us don't want to pay attention to. Like Lynn was saying, let's mine closer to home so we have maybe more controls over it. But LEDs, wind turbines, solar panels, tell us about the process of making it, because there is nothing green about that.
No, I mean, you know, certainly people are like miners are more conscious than they were in the past, but mining is dirty. In order to get to make a silicon chip, okay, so take that silicon chip, the most amazing little thing that we're capable of making these days. And when we're talking about LEDs, it's a not dissimilar process, because that's a form of silicon technology, as is, by the way, solar panels. So this all goes for solar panels, it goes for silicon chips, it goes for LEDs. You have to dig stuff out of the ground. You know, smartphones, the brains of a smartphone is a rock. It's just a rock that we have processed a lot. You have to blast the rock out of the ground. You have to transform that rock through a whole host of different processes. You have to kind of melt it down in a smelter alongside coal, by the way. That's one of the processes to make a solar panel. You melt it alongside coal and wood chips in an electric arc furnace. That gets you something that's pretty pure. You need to process it all over again in another process called the Siemens process. That gets you something even more pure. You need to break that down again in another process called the Cichrowski process. That gets you something that's not only kind of chemically pure, 99.999999999, 10 or 12 nines. I can't remember how many nines I just said. But anyway, something that's so pure, it is basically the purest thing that humankind is ever capable of making. But even that's not good enough, because it needs to be atomically perfect. So you break it down all over again and reform it all over again. Each of these different processes, okay, and I'm simplifying enormously, each of these different processes is necessary if you're taking a rock out of the ground and turning it into a pure piece of silicon wafer that you then will go on to turn into a silicon chip or a solar panel or an LED. But that takes so much energy. There's more carbon emissions per ton in making a silicon chip than there is in making steel. And steel is about the biggest polluter in the planet. Now, On the flip side, we don't make as many tons of silicon chips, thank God, as we do steel. But it just underlines there is a footprint to everything. And when you're thinking about data centers, when you're thinking about AI, okay, we've got to think about the energy consumption that these things involve, but also think about the manufacturer of all of these chips that NVIDIA and so on are making. That all has a footprint. And part of the issue that we faced in recent years is because we just haven't really thought about this stuff, or we've allowed it to happen on the other side of the planet, and a lot of it's been outsourced to China. Because of that, we've just forgotten what the reality of making this stuff actually is. And right now, if you're buying, like, I don't want to get too political, but if you're buying like a solar panel from somewhere else, let's say from China, the pollution that that might be creating, we just don't really know what the compromises are, because the standards of environmental regulations are much lower. The labor standards are much lower, which brings us back to that kind of issue of, if we want to make this stuff more domestically, we're going to have to relearn how to do it. We're going to have to kind of face up to the fact that it's quite energy intensive and pollution intensive. And that means then understanding that getting to net zero is tough. And it's interesting, you know, frankly, this is a much more interesting conversation than the ones we had 5, 10 years ago when it was like, oh, great, we'll just put a wind turbine in there and we don't need to think any more about it.
Well, in your book, Material World, you talk about these six raw materials that shape our civilization, and you include salt. I just have to ask you why, how salt got in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, it, to me, it's almost my favorite one because it's the most counterintuitive. Like, when you think of that, of salt, you just think of the condiment, you know, you think of the thing that's there on the table when you're eating. And of course it is that, and we still need salt for literally for the electrical system in our bodies. Salt is all important. But for back at, you know, 2000 years ago in the Roman era, salt was seen as the absolutely essential ingredient for your health. I mean, the Roman goddess was the goddess of salt. Each of the Roman soldiers was given rations of salt. It was, that's where the word salary derives from. It comes back to that. And so we kind of think that's all historical. But even today, okay, if you look at the pharmaceutical sector, 90% of all pharmaceuticals, all drugs, have ingredients that are derived from salt. The vast majority of products we use on a daily basis, you know, paper, glass, metals, they have all depended in one way or another on chemicals we get from salt. And why is that? It's because salt is basically the bedrock for a large chunk of the whole chemicals sector. So if you're thinking about things like caustic soda, it's a really important chemical for breaking stuff down. If you're making paper, if you're making, you know, silicon chips, you need caustic soda and various ingredients that come that come from it in order to do that. If you're making lithium-ion batteries, you need caustic soda, you need soda ash. These mostly are derived from salt. There's a place that I visited. It's kind of a factory in the UK where we take the brine that comes out of the ground. So there's a lot of salt in certain parts of the UK, just like there is in the US, some of it under the ground. And we pump up, it's called solution mining. Rather than sending someone down with an axe, you just pump down water and then you pump up, you're pumping up kind of brine. So really, really concentrated salt water, about 30% salt water. Very salty, I tasted it. It was unbearably salty. And then you send that through an electrolysis process. So there's this big room, a big kind of plant that has all of these different electrolysis cells quite close to where the salt is, because it's, like I said, it's been pumped up from the ground. This plant, which by the way uses more electricity than the city of Liverpool, so it is using so much power. This place is producing, because using the electrolysis breaks down that sodium chloride into a few different chemicals, including chlorine and caustic soda. And the chlorine that it uses then goes into purifying our tap water. And it turns out this is the only plant in the UK doing this process, a single plant. And when I was walking around there, one of the guys said, if this place goes down, then within 7 days, we are rationing drinking water across this country. Still depend on salt to keep us alive, even today. And we have these kind of choke points, these linkages, these places which no one really spends much time thinking about, which are part of our life support system.
Wow, that's really interesting. Okay, so you wrote this book, it came out in 2023, and I'm wondering, since then, a lot has shifted in the world, you know, especially in the last, for us in the last 3 months, four or 5 months, whatever it's been, where we're looking at more of a tariff situation, which will preclude the use of and the importation of all the critical elements, and especially from places like China. What would be the epilogue to your book at this point, you know, a year and a half later?
I think it's that people have become more conscious. When I started writing this stuff was definitely not seen as sexy. And now it's seen as a bit more sexy and a little bit more kind of front page news, because you've got Donald Trump talking about critical minerals and you've got China blocking off its exports of rare earth metals, which are pretty important when it comes to, you know, lots of electronics. So I think everyone's much more conscious about it. By the same token, what hasn't changed is that while people are kind of conscious in the abstract about it, that they're still maybe a bit less curious than they could be. It reminds me of the, you know, that the film Avatar. There's this metal that they're seeking on this planet called unobtainium. This mysterious metal, unobtainium, that no one is quite sure what it is or what it actually does, but they just know it's important. And I kind of often feel it's the same with things like rare earths and critical minerals. No one's quite kind of interrogated whether this stuff, why this stuff is important. Would it be a problem if we didn't have the supplies of silicon going across the world that becomes silicon chips? Yes, that would be a problem. And so I think interrogating that would be is always helpful. I think the other thing that's changed is that when I wrote the book, everyone, I think there was a consensus about net zero and about carbon emissions and carbon reduction. That feels like that's being challenged at the moment. And obviously Donald Trump has a very different view on that from Joe Biden. I think the thing that's interesting in the kind of common strand is that throughout this, China has been absolutely kind of powering on ahead in thinking about minerals and materials and where we get them from. There's one country in the world that does think about this stuff. It is China. And they have been, over the course of the last kind of 20 years, really, building up supply chains. They don't have much copper in China, so they're going out to places in sub-Saharan Africa to get it. They don't have much cobalt. Same thing again. Don't have much rare earths, but they want to do the refining. They are thinking about this stuff in a way that the rest of us aren't. And the upshot is they have a stranglehold on many of these different networks of how we get stuff out of the ground and turn them into products. That then makes this possible trade war that we're in right now, well, it kind of is a trade war, it makes it much more nerve-wracking.
Well, Ed, I found your Substack, which is a phenomenal read. So anyone that wants to read more about this, your Substack is a really great place to start in addition to the book. In it, you talked about aluminum, or aluminium, as you like to say. It seems to be the most forgotten material, but it's everywhere. Tell us about that extraction process, because it's enormous as well.
Yeah, and you know an interesting thing about aluminium, I can't kick my pronunciation, I'm afraid. Even though technically speaking, I think the American pronunciation, I'm not allowed to say this in here in the UK, but I can say it to an American station. The American pronunciation, I think, is the right way to do it, just linguistically. Anyway, this, without aluminium, we don't have flight. I mean, like, start with that. Powered flights, it relies on aluminium, even though these days we have ever more kind of composites going into planes. And the process of getting bauxite out of the ground and turning that into alumina and then turning that into aluminium, it is a hard, really energy intensive process. And we don't do much of it in the US or indeed in the UK. And that's part of the pitfall of America imposing tariffs on aluminium, is that it's really hard to start up an old industrial process that you haven't been doing for a long time. And I don't know how that's going to go. I think it's just going to be really, really tricky, because it just makes importing this stuff much more expensive, which in turn makes it more expensive to make planes and makes it more expensive to make electric cars. You need a lot of aluminium for electric cars. It makes it more expensive to make this exciting new grid that you need if you're going to electrify the country. Because aluminium, actually, while copper's the most important thing for electricity, aluminium's really important when you've got high voltage power cables going long distances, because it's quite light. It's a really light metal, and it also is pretty conductive. And for all of those reasons, it is massively important. And it missed the threshold in my book for being included, but it's if I were doing a sequel, it would be in there, because it's also kind of cool with the way it's made, because it's made in this process using electrolysis, which we didn't discover until about just over 100 years ago. And before that, even though aluminium is actually pretty common within the Earth's crust, it was so hard to refine that it was worth more than gold. And so when, I think it was Napoleon, one of the kind of descendants of Napoleon, wanted to impress all of his subjects, he would put aluminium cutlery on the table, not gold, aluminium, because it was so, so expensive. And then we discovered a way of making it cheaply, and the world changed forever. And that's the amazing thing about human progress. We have all of these breakthrough moments, similar thing for silicon chips, similar thing for steel, these breakthrough moments where suddenly we go from not really understanding how to make something to understanding how to making something. And it changes everything. But here's the kind of slightly unsettling thing. So many of these processes, like making aluminium, like making steel, like making the silicon that goes into silicon chips, these processes we're still using today are well over 100 years old, and we just simply haven't come up with anything better to do that stuff. However, pretty much all of these processes are really carbon intensive. And so the challenge of net zero and decarbonizing is we need to rethink all of that stuff. We need to rethink the entire industrial revolution. You know, it is that deep, because all of the, what was the industrial revolution? It was all of these amazing discoveries. Well, loads of those discoveries are massively pollutive. So we're going to do this seriously. We need to rethink that whole thing, which is an enormous scientific engineering challenge.
Well, Ed Conway is our guest, and his book is Material World, The Six Raw Materials That Shape Modern Civilization. And Ed, before we let you go, I just have to ask you, it's funny, I was at a dinner last night, and a friend of mine, her daughter is getting a PhD in some type of geology, and she was lamenting, oh, she's probably, you know, she'll end up working for an oil company. And as I've been talking to you here, I think there is hope. There is hope that these young people who are going and getting PhDs in some type of geology, there are hope to improve them, the mining practices. And I...
Oh, she should have so much hope. And also, geologists and people who work in mining are going to be the people who help get us out of the hole that we've made ourselves. That's, you know, excuse the pun. But I mean, if we don't discover a way of getting more copper out of the ground and also doing it in a more environmentally friendly way and also recycling stuff better, and recycling is kind of like mining because you're taking old materials and finding a way of getting the metals out of them. The old materials are a bit like ores, the old smartphones and so on that you're recycling. If we don't do that stuff, then we're in real trouble. And what worries me actually above all else is there's a lot of people earnestly who say to themselves, well, I won't go into mining. I won't go into geology because it's dirty. If I went back and had my time again, I would be an engineer, not, you know, some kind of person blathering on as a journalist in journalism, because that honestly is the most inspiring course, you know, career that I can imagine, because you're finding the solutions and you're solutions oriented. And we need more people like that, not fewer.
Ed Conway, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, is a system of ocean currents that circulates water within the Atlantic Ocean. There is concern that the AMOC could weaken when ice sheets in Greenland melt, releasing larger quantities of fresh water into the ocean.
If this water, which is less dense than salt water, reaches the North Atlantic current, it could potentially slow the rate at which waters in the AMOC sink to the seafloor. And this whole system could collapse. But so far, it's hanging in there. Joining us now to help us understand all of this is science and environmental journalist Umberto Basilio, who recently wrote an article that appeared in Scientific American and Nature titled "The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, is Safe from Climate Collapse for Now." Umberto, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is a complex topic, so we're going to get really simple on it.
Yeah.
I think that I had never heard of the AMOC until recently. I've heard in the news that it is, you know, in danger of collapse. So can you explain it a little better than I just did, than we just did in the intro?
Right. Well, yeah, I think your explanation was really good, actually, but sure. The AMOC is basically this giant system of ocean currents in the Atlantic Ocean that plays a huge role in regulating climate. And it transports warm water from the tropics up toward to the North Atlantic, which is the Gulf Stream, and then sends colder, denser water back down south at deeper layers of the ocean. You can kind of think of it as a conveyor belt moving heat and nutrients around the planet. And the importance of it is that without it, large parts of Europe would be much colder, for example, and a lot of global weather patterns would look very, very different.
And so when we talk about just keep this staying in equilibrium or in balance, can you talk about what the recent threats have been to upset that balance?
Yeah, sure. The I mean, I think we have to talk about like how it happens first. So the whole system is powered by differences in temperature and salinity, what scientists call thermohaline circulation. Warm water travels northward near the surface, and when it reaches the North Atlantic, especially near Greenland, it cools and becomes saltier due to evaporation. That makes it denser, and so it sinks deep into the ocean. That sinking water creates a sort of vacuum that pulls more warm water up from the south, and then the cold, deep water flows southward and eventually gets recirculated. So it's a constant loop driven by temperature.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science journalist Umberto Basilio. He has recently written an article for Scientific American called "The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, AMOC, is Safe from Climate Collapse." Well, you just mentioned thermohaline circulation, which I remember learning about years ago, and it is that global oceanic conveyor belt. But in this article, they are just studying the Atlantic component of this. What are all of the components? Because it's a big globe with more than just the Atlantic. How big of an area does the Atlantic, the AMOC system, cover?
It goes all the way from, the Antarctic area, so basically Greenland, and all the way down into the tropic, and it then goes all the way around through I think it is basically the southern part of India. Yeah, basically that side of Asia. So it's a loop that goes all around.
So if this were to collapse or even slow down, you had mentioned briefly that it will affect climates in various parts of the world, especially you think about Northern Europe. How does it control the climate in areas like Ireland and Europe right now? Because they're so far north, but yet it's such a temperate climate. What is AMOC doing to help keep those climates livable, if you will?
Right. The it is definitely a natural system. It's been around for a long time, and it's part of how the planet regulates heat. But what's happening now is that human-caused climate change is interfering with it. As the planet warms, ice sheets in places like Greenland are melting rapidly, and that meltwater is fresh, not salty. And at the same time, there's more rainfall in the North Atlantic. All that fresh water sits on the surface and makes the ocean less salty, which means it's also less dense and doesn't sink as easily. And if that sinking slows down too much, the whole circulation can weaken or eventually stop. If the AMOC were to collapse, it would be a global event with really serious consequences. Europe, especially places like the UK and Scandinavia, would get significantly colder, and sea levels would rise along the US coast. The tropics might become even hotter, and major rainfall patterns like the monsoons in West Africa and South Asia could be disrupted. Agriculture, water supplies, storm patterns, all of that could be affected. And it wouldn't happen overnight, but the shift would be traumatic and hard to reverse.
Yeah. So I'm curious about this tipping point because the way I've heard it in the media, it's made me believe like, this whole thing could just change on this day and then it collapses and all of these changes. But can you tell us if it's like much more gradual than that, or are we seeing effects around, on land currently from this? I mean, I think some of these extreme weather events, are they effects from the AMOC weakening?
The tipping point, that's interesting. That was one of the questions that I was really interested in, like understanding like what the tipping point is exactly. So the tipping point is when you add so much fresh water to the North Atlantic that the water can't sink anymore, basically, at least not in the volume needed to keep the system going. And once the density drops below a certain threshold, the conveyor belt breaks. And after that, the system might not recover even if we reduce emissions or stop the fresh water input. So it's kind of a point of no return, and that's what scientists but that well, that's what has scientists concerned, right? We don't know exactly where that threshold is, but we do know we're inching closer to it.
So How long have you been studying this, and what, you know, first made you interested in this? I mean, is it like one of the biggest components of climate change?
Yeah, I mean, it is something. I mean, I started like studying this earlier this year when I wrote the piece for Nature, and I was not aware about like exactly what was it. I've been hearing about it a little bit. Most of the times in a very like dramatic way, because many people talk about it as it could be, you know, the end of the times, the end of the world if it happens, like if it stop working, functioning. Sorry, I think for most people, they wasn't on the radar until some pretty alarming studies came out in recent years warning that it might collapse sooner than expected. One paper also published in Nature even suggested it could happen within decades before the end of this century, which was very alarming. And I think that's when people really started talking about that and started like knowing more about it. That got a lot of headlines, actually. But oceanographers and climate scientists have been studying this system for a long time. It's just that these newer high profile predictions caught you know, the public attention, and the stakes are so high that even a small chance of collapse is enough to make people pay attention to it. But basically what I'm writing in this article I wrote for Nature, and what the scientists found, is that that's not going to happen, at least in this century. We still have a chance of trying to understand how it's actually working, what scientists could do to better understand like what we might do to not get into that tipping point.
Well, Umberto, you mentioned earlier the effects of this circulation on land, but also it has a massive effect on sea life and the ocean's health. How does this transit of this warmer or colder salty water affect the ocean's health?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I think any change in the environment has a huge affectation over marine life. We know that for sure, right? Like we know that any change, you know, if we eliminate a species in the ocean, that will have a huge effect on the marine life. The AMOC is such a big like component of the regulation of the temperature in the ocean that if it stopped, really, that would have a huge impact, because that would affect specifically, I mean, the whole marine life in the world, right? Because, you know, there are some species that survive or that have like certain adaptations to the temperature of the parts of the ocean they're living at. And so changing the way that happens could have a huge effect on them. They will not be able to survive if the temperatures start changing as fast as it could if the AMOC just stops. There are a lot of nutrients that are traveling all around the planet through the AMOC, and you know, a lot of marine species, I don't know the exact number, would not be able to make it, because they will not be getting those nutrients on their environments, and therefore that would be like a huge catastrophe for the marine life in there.
Well, in reading your article, one of the things the scientists said will help curtail the collapse of the AMOC is our winds. And I've never really thought about winds affecting ocean current, because, you know, what I've known about thermohaline circulation is it's the melting of the Greenland ice, mm-hmm. and that sinking of the water that starts the pump, if you will. Mm-hmm. But what is wind's role in this global conveyor belt?
Yeah, so winds basically are the ones who are driving the current, and the way they interact is what basically keeps the water moving, is what basically keeps the water just going in one direction. As I say at the beginning of the interview, when the water reaches a certain point due to other reasons like salinity, it changes like how deep into the ocean it goes, but the currents are basically what is moving the water all around the world.
You mentioned, Umberto, before that this, when this came into the news media, there was just a lot of maybe hype about it. And I think you, did you say something like, you know, the end of days? And I'm wondering how much there's this kind of doomsday movement around this whole concept. Did you find that? Like, how much is based on science and how much is based on hype and hysteria?
Right. I think there's a lot of hysteria, mostly because when this first study appeared in, I think it was almost a decade ago. I don't remember exactly when was it, but it's a paper that was published in Nature as well. They were saying that the AMOC could like stop working before the end of the century. A lot of people just took that information and started spreading the news as if it was like a doomsday, as if scientists were saying that, you know, by 2099 we were gonna die because this huge current that does something spectacular would stop, and then therefore we will all, you know, that would be like the end of the world. But I think that was a misinterpretation of what the authors were saying at that point. I actually talked with one of the authors of this study, and what he was saying was that at that point there was not much research like around that, and they were using these climate models in order to try to understand like what would be that tipping point, or that moment where it would be not like the moment we would not want to reach, because that would be so dangerous for the world. But they were just like trying to make a prediction on what could happen. So, but the first thing that he said while I was interviewing him was that all these climate models are not like very actually representative of reality, and they were working with the little amount of information they had by that time. Yeah, and so this new study, I think it just represents like how these climate models have advanced in the last decade, and they are, you know, able to make such better predictions of what could happen, and they contrast the information we had before from other climate models. So it will be constantly changing, but it would be more accurate as time passes by. Basically, people do not have anything to worry about right now, AMOC-wise, I think. I think we'll be fine, but that does not mean that we should not be trying to do as much as possible in order to stop altering the environment and accelerating climate change, because that's what ultimately will bring us to this final stage that we would not want to reach.
So Katie mentioned wind as something, one of the forces that will keep the AMOC stable and functioning as it is. What are some other forces?
The main force is still that deep water formation in the North Atlantic, the process where salty cold water sinks and drives the circulation. But smaller ocean processes like eddies and vertical mixing are proving to be really important too. They help redistribute salt and heat in ways that make the system more resilient than we thought. Of course, if we keep, you know, adding more fresh water to the mix, even those stabilizing forces might not be enough in the long run.
Umberto, how did you get into science journalism? Because your topics are incredibly diverse. What got you into this area?
That's a very interesting question. I think I studied journalism for my undergraduate, and then I was just trying to find what bit could I cover. I studied journalism in Mexico, and I think science journalism is not that spread in science journalism schools in there. So I got the luck of finding a research center in my university that was doing science communications and doing some, you know, they were teaching how to do science communications, and they were looking for people that studied journalism and that studied communications in general in order to, you know, join them to do science communication about this research center. And then I met another person in there who was a science journalist already working for big outlets as Nature and Science and other publications. And she was the one who basically taught me like what science journalism was. And I got so intrigued by that. And I was very amazed about it because no one else around me, not my friends, not my teachers, were doing science journalism. And I do think that science journalism in Mexico is still something that it's, I think people think of science journalism just as these articles at the last page of the paper saying like, hey, come look at this, like this event of, you know, observing stars or this. People think about it as soft news most of the time. And this journalist I met who was my mentor, I think the first time I heard her talking about like the importance of science journalism, I just got like very interested into it. And I just started like going into it. And I started my career as a science, as a freelancer. And I think as in order to, you know, survive as a freelancer, you have to write as you cannot just like stay in one bit because you will have to find any publication to write for because you want to get money sometimes. And I just started like understanding that it is not, I mean, I have to understand the science, of course, but I have so many tools. I've been, you know, covering archaeology and astronomy and climate science. And I always have amazing editors that will help me, you know, work through my drafts and that will help me polish them. And that's something that made me feel that I can cover like whatever science I want to cover.
Well, I think, you know, like Glenn and I can attest to the challenges of always trying to find the best topics because there's so many out there and how do you pick? But I recently read an article of yours in the New York Times about the racing that has been done in Chile across the deserts and all of the damage that's being done to this ancient art. Tell our listeners a little bit about that because I thought it was such an interesting thing. And again, something that most of us had never heard of.
Yeah, I got that story because I was in contact with this advocacy group that they are some archaeologists and also people that live around the Atacama Desert in Chile. The Atacama Desert is the driest place on Earth. I remember them like trying to make people know that there were some racers, some off-road racers. They drive, you know, bikes and buggies and jeeps and stuff like that in the desert because they love the desert for doing that, those races, because it's like, you know, it's part of the how, I mean, it's an extreme sport, so they want to go over these dunes and do all those type of stuff. And I reached out to them because I saw that they were like posting some very dramatic photos of the damage that they made to these ancient geoglyphs that were almost 3,000 years old. And I was very surprised by that. I started making some calls and they told me basically that these careers are being done there without supervision. The Chile's government should be like trying to, you know, limit the zones where these races take place, but they're not doing a great job, partially because the desert is huge and they cannot, you know, just like have people all around the desert trying to protect every part of it. But also the Chilean government is also not like very interested in protecting it or making enough efforts to protect it because these careers bring a lot of profit for many people. So these careers have been happening for the last decade with minimal supervision. We're just seeing the effects now. They destroy these big geoglyphs that are cultural heritage of the country. And the archaeologists are very, very, you know, concerned and sad about that because that is something that they will not recover. It's history that they will not recover, and they're now just trying to document this huge damage in order to show people what could happen if governments do not protect heritage as they should.
This leads me back, as you were talking, Humberto, I was thinking about how you, as an investigative journalist, science journalist, how you sift through, you know, there's a lot of fake science out there now. Yeah. And how you go about in your job finding the science that's factual and peer reviewed and all of that.
Part of it is just being skeptic with everything you read. Of course, there are some sources that are more reliable than others, not the same reading an article that was written for Nature or Science or any of those big journals than reading something in a random website, right? But most of the times when I have doubts about anything, I would reach out to as many sources as possible in order to get like a balance of what is really happening, because that's the only way you will understand the nuance of the science we're reading, right? I just try to do that. I just try to also, like, you know, talk to other people who's involved around any issues, not just scientists, but, you know, the communities that are being affected by whatever is happening. So what I want to do is just like to contrast all the point of views in order to understand what is really happening. And about this fake science, I think it is very easy to sometimes when you talk to experts, they will like point out like what are the things that are not right with that science, and they will help you understand better like what are you actually reading. So I just think skepticism and trying to be really in touch with sources, with experts.
What are those questions that we should ask ourselves in order to find who's really an expert or what science is real? To me, it seems pretty apparent when you read really bad science, but what are those questions we might ask?
Yeah, I think the first question is, while we're reading an article, for example, we have to find what were the sources that the writer used for writing that article first. We have to see if the science they're talking about was published in peer-reviewed papers. That's the first thing, I think, just trying to see what are the sources of the article we're reading. And the second, I think, would be trying to see if also the sources they're bringing to the article. Sometimes I've seen some journalists that just like bring any type of expert to comment on whatever science they're writing about, right? So they would not go and try to interview climate scientists to talk about climate science, but any other type of scientist just to comment on climate science, which is not correct because every type of science is very different. So we would just have to be very careful to try to see what are the sources of the article. Try to not believe instantly in any type of news that is like dramatic and intense, because most of the times those news are created to bring readers in that way, right? But with sensationalism. So be careful with those articles. I think a good journalist will try to tell you what is wrong, as in this story about the AMOC, like what could happen, but at the same time they will tell you like, it is not as bad as we think. This is the other science that shows that we're not gonna, that the AMOC won't stop in this century, but this is what we have to do. So
Humberto Basilio is our guest. He's a science and environmental journalist, and we've been talking to him about all kinds of things, but about his article in Nature, which is called "The AMOC is Safe from Climate Collapse for Now." Humberto Basilio, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. If you have ideas for a future show, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And if you like today's episode, rate us, leave us a comment, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.